It's the Not-So-Ancient Wisdom Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, T-Rex is badass again, The View's anti-vax failure, just what kind of an atheist are you, and just how ancient is some of those ancient wisdoms. Let's begin episode 219.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, I felt so sorry for you today. I mean, you were sitting there and you were telling me about all the troubles you had trying to get to the show today, with Wreck Beach being crowded and all that. But we did have a glimmer of hope that, you know, in a few thousand million years, you'll be able to look back and the entire West Coast will be changed. There will be no more Wreck Beach. There will be no car triangles. All problems will be solved in time, won't they?
Well, yeah, but am I going to be around when that happens?
No, but some archaeologists will come across and will be able to solve a great controversy that, you know, is Wreck Beach really the most traffic-snarled road in the world?
Well, you know, they're not very good at solving controversies, these archaeologists. And here's an example of it. They have made a very cool discovery in finding a T-Rex tooth, but it solves nothing.
What?
That's right. For many years now, there has been a battle raging over the nature of the most famous dinosaur, the Tyrannosaurus Rex. Was it a ferocious predator or a lonesome scavenger? Hardly worthy of any discussion on radio or podcast.
Why a lonesome scavenger? Can't you say industrious recycler?
No.
No.
Anyway, the latest discovery from the paleontologists who found the remains of a prehistoric skirmish in the Hell Creek Formation in South Dakota, what they discovered was a battle between two dinosaurs, which occurred around 66 million years ago, involving a T-Rex and a large plant-eating hadrosaur. And what they discovered was a tooth from the T-Rex implanted in the spine of the hadrosaur.
I can just imagine. Quite exciting.
Yes, it's just like Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Scans of the tooth and the surrounding tail vertebrae show that there were actually signs of healing around the wound, which is proof that the hadrosaur was alive at the time of the attack and survived for several months or even years afterwards. So, I guess proving that the T-Rex can hunt, but it's not very good at it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have a quote here from the paper authors. This is an unambiguous evidence that T-Rex was an active predator. Such evidence is rare in the fossil record for good reason. Prey rarely escapes.
But that's true.
Well, that is true. The proceedings, or the paper was found, was written in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And, you know, you'd think, okay, well, this is pretty good evidence.
Well, but, I mean, which is worse, though, having a tooth stuck in your back or for the Tyrannosaurus to have lost a tooth? I mean, teeth must be pretty important to the Tyrannosaurus.
Well, yeah, of course. The thing with the T-Rex, of course, is that they do shed their teeth.
Like sharks?
Yes. Well, they're a little bit related. Anyway, the tooth in question was, I believe, from back of the T-Rex's mouth, where they apparently those teeth were weaker and they tend to fall out more often, I guess. And so when it bit the tail of its prey, I assume that whatever it was, it spasmed around and knocked the teeth out. So, I mean, okay, so here we have literally a smoking tooth. You would think that the question of whether or not the T-Rex was a predator or a scavenger is now solved, right?
Well, one thing I'd be curious. You said it's in the tail? So it's in the vertebrae, but lower?
Yeah, well, you know how dinosaurs are. Their spine is like, you know, halfway before their tail is there's their lower vertebrae than the tail itself.
If you think of it bit on the tail, that's not really a prey kind of thing. I mean, you don't kill an animal by biting its tail. You beat it by biting its neck. That's pretty common.
Well, I suppose thing. It would depend on how big the animal is that it's trying to kill. I mean, the T-Rex, I mean, it's not exactly the most efficiently designed predator. It's basically just a big mouth with a, you know.
On a set of legs.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the opposite of a shark, where it's just a big mouth attached to a fin. But as I was saying, you'd think that this would put to rest the debate over whether or not the T-Rex was the predator. Well, it hasn't at all. Paleontologists expressed mixed reactions to the finding. Jack Horner at the Museum of the Rockies in Montana, who served as a technical advisor in Jurassic Park, said, quote, "This one piece of evidence does seem to suggest that the Tyrannosaurus bit a hadrosaur, but certainly doesn't provide any indication of what sort of carnivore the Rex actually was." Horner, he believes that the T-Rex was more like a hyena, and he states that the paper published in the National Academy of Science really doesn't refute that hypothesis. Basically, all the only evidence it provides is that a T-Rex at one point bit a hadrosaur.
Right, just like, you know, if you, I'm trying to think, a cow will try and bite you if you poke it in the wrong way. You know, it's not like cows are carnivores. If you annoy it, we have an instinct to bite.
Mm-hmm. Paul Barrett, who is a dinosaur researcher at the Natural History Museum in London, said, quote, "The whole T-Rex scavenger or predator debate is pretty intractable and not particularly enlightening. Work on living carnivores like big cats or wolves clearly show that they use both strategies depending on what's available to them. They'll generally make do with a meal from either source if it satisfies their dietary needs. Any other extinct carnivore, including T-Rex, is likely to have been the same." So basically what he's saying here is that if the T-Rex was any kind of predator, what we know about them is that they're basically opportunistic. They will take a carcass, they will take, if they have to chase down a prey, they will, but they're not fussy.
No, which again is pretty common in the animal world. I mean, most animals tend to be opportunistic as far as their feeding habits goes, and the ones that aren't are dead.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you pass up a meal, and I mean, we're not talking about carrion eaters either, because that's sort of a different class. Because there is, I should clarify that. There is one risk to eating a dead animal is it's a host for infections and biological diseases and all that. But if you are a scavenger, that could mean you just eat sort of fresh kills as opposed to something that has had some time to ferment.
Well, the other thing, too, is some carnivore or scavengers that we know of today are scavengers because they don't have the ability to take down prey, or they don't have the claws or the fangs necessarily to get at the food they want to eat. So, you know, they need another animal to rip open something before they can get inside and get any of the organs.
And there's also another real simple explanation that could occur for this is that pushed to a limit, any animal will do anything. So if it's a quote-unquote active carnivore and he hasn't been able to make a kill yet and he sees a dead animal, he doesn't normally eat dead animals, but hey, I'm really hungry. And conversely, a scavenger, if you haven't come across a meal in a long time, you're going to make in a few swipes at whatever happens to be handy, like a hadrosaur's tail, just because you're starving to death and you're desperate.
Yeah. So again, cool discovery solves nothing.
Yeah, no, boo, yeah, no. Well, maybe we can solve one thing here, Ethan.
Okay.
What kind of an atheist are you?
The best kind.
Yes. We've reported on the show many times about the growing number of people who are no longer religious, the, quote, no religious affiliation type. Of course, it's also been pointed out that this does not necessarily mean that they're all atheists or that they share sort of one common worldview. Research done, though, at the University of Tennessee has attempted to explore this issue. Through a combination of polling and interview, they've divided up our community into six types. I thought it might be interesting in a sort of introspective way to see how these different groups fit. So the first group they have is the intellectual atheist slash agnostic. Now take note, many times when I say the word atheist, I mean atheist slash agnostic. I don't like saying those words all the time. So just take it as read as that. So these people, although they don't believe in God, they do love intellectual debate. They will discuss religion, atheism, but don't sort of let that determine their social group. That is, and to quote, they will associate with fellow intellectuals regardless of their ontological position, provided that they are versed and educated on various issues of science, philosophy, rational theology, and common social, political, religious dialogues. Now, I would question what rational theology is, But again, these are people who are atheists, but they don't sort of define their social group as an atheist. Like, you must be an atheist for me to talk to you. But they just, anyone who offers them a good intellectual debate, let's debate. The next group they have are the activists. Like the intellectuals, they don't see their mission is to rid the world of the evils of religion, but they are on a mission. This mission is humanitarian in shape. So they sort of, quote again, they seek to be both vocal and proactive regarding current issues in the atheist community with regards to social political sphere. So this group, again, has been making a lot of news in our sort of skeptic/atheist community lately because they're looking beyond the traditional role of this community and are attempting to take on social and political issues like inequality, sexism, and that sort of thing, and move the mandate of atheist skepticism beyond what it traditionally has been. There is the seeker agnostic. These are people, in my opinion, are the most annoying people in the world. They're the ones who say, I don't know, but neither do you. It could be true or not. The ultimate philosophical fence sitters. They have taken uncertainty and embraced it as a belief system.
These are like D&D characterizations. Are you neutral, good, evil? I'm a half-elf seeker agnostic.
Well, kind of, again, they said that statistically these groups sort of exist, but I think at the end we'll go back over and see how these go, because I have a different take on what they've done here.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the anti-theist. These are the new atheists, what I have often termed as the evangelical fundamentalist atheists. People, like me, who are not content to know that there's no God, but feel the need to deconvert others, to tear down the destructive influences organized religion has had in our society. The non-theist. These are people who don't care. They don't believe, but they've never really thought about it. This is, you know, the sort of, meh, you believe in God, eh. But this group, though, needs a rather particular environment in order to exist. One that's not so hard to have here in Canada, but in many parts of the world, you don't really have the option to have no opinion on religion.
Mm-hmm.
The ritual atheist. These are people who don't believe in God, but like at least some of the trappings of organized religion. These are the people who are sort of creating and populating the Sunday service movement in the atheist community. So sort of think Scandinavia, where you have some of the highest levels of atheism, and yet also some of the highest affiliations with the church, where organized religion has transformed into a social/cultural institution, no God required. You also see this with the cultural Jews, who do religious practices not out of belief, but out of tradition. You can also think a lot about Christmas. You know, the holiday has evolved in good and bad ways, far from its sort of Christian origins. So, you know, like Christmas is one of those great ones that in many senses, I love the idea that it's one time we get to sort of come together, we say we're all one great people, we care about people regardless of what their relationship is to us, and I think that's a really good sort of institution for society.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, it has all this other baggage. So one article had pointed out, which I thought was kind of funny, that was talking about this particular study, that of the six groups, this last group, this sort of ritual atheist, are the most disturbing. And to quote the article, the Christian Post titled their coverage of the study, "Researchers, ritual atheists could be a ritual atheist could be sitting next to you in church." And given the first few paragraphs over to the concerns that people in your very own congregation may not actually believe in your God. The atheism, it seems, might be coming from inside the house of God. So it's not that they hate atheists so much. It's like these, I don't know what you would call them, fifth column in the church that they see is damaging.
Well, they're like Cylons or something. I mean, it's even worse for them because according to, you know, pretty respectable research, not only could there be an atheist sitting next to them, they're... pastor, the leader of the congregation, may be an atheist themselves.
But that must put them in a rather odd quandary because they're fulfilling all of the, you know, ritual that they need to believe. And the fact that you might go to hell and I'm going to go to heaven is great, but we both are sort of maintaining the church's role in society, right? You know how you have the war on Christmas?
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's a group of atheists who would be very much... in support of being against this war on Christmas, right? They want, sure, let's have the whole nativity thing in the schools and, you know, we love this, you know, Christmas mass type thing. Great, let's have it all. They still don't believe, but they like all the pomp and ceremony. One of the things I thought was interesting about this one, in the whole study in general, is I do think it tied into a different thing. Now, they try to group these as sort of separate, independent groups of people. But I think in many ways, this is actually more... dimensions of one person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I mean, some people are the evangelical type, right, to a lesser or greater extent. I know religion in my life plays next to no, so in one sense, I'm kind of a meh kind of person. Mm-hmm. I do like some of the religious trappings, like I say, at Christmas, I like that sort of idea. I'm also sort of an activist in many ways. So I think one of the things I had trouble with this sort of survey is I kind of like, you know, the breakdown, but the idea that these seem somehow are separate and almost incompatible groups.
Well, the other thing, too, is that we know a fair bit about sociology and how people get along with other people. We know that more often than not, it's all about you tend to associate with people of your class. So if you're, you know, on the lower income level, you tend to associate with other people who are in the same class. You don't go to like a swanky club and hang out with people. You go to where you find people who you think are like you. And if you're in, I mean, it doesn't have to be a small town. If you're in any kind of community and the people who are most like you happen to be religious, you're probably going to hang out with them. And that's probably going to impact how you view religion and your own belief system. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if your best friend or your significant other is a sports fan and you're not, you know, you're not necessarily going to say, well, you know, I'm an anti-sports fan who goes to sporting events. You're just going to say, well, I don't really care, but my spouse loves it, so I go with them, right?
And whatever's like important to them is kind of important to me, so I will put up with it. And I think that actually goes great with the first one, the intellectual atheist, is that, you know, if you want to have a good debate about, you know, should we tax the rich?
Yeah.
Somehow it doesn't really seem important whether your religious beliefs are X, Y, or Z. In that kind of, you can have a very debate with the Pope if you wanted to, although he might have conflict of interest because he's kind of rich in a way.
But. Yeah, he is, yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing about this, too, is, I mean, and just sort of thinking about what my encounters with various atheist groups and people in the community of free thinkers is that it's really hard to categorize atheism because it's such a, I guess for lack of a better term, it's a new phenomenon that we're dealing with here. And I found it really hard to pigeonhole anyone into any kind of belief system or view of the world based purely on the fact that they don't believe something.
Yeah.
You know, it would be like going to a stamp collecting convention and going, well, clearly these are all going to be, you know, left-leaning
meat eaters.
Yeah, like, I mean, like, well, how do you there's only one thing that connects these people. There's no way to assume that from this one thing we can assume all these other things about their character.
That's why, again, I like the idea of seeing this as sort of dimensions of an individual, but not a casing for the individual.
Yeah.
Right? And actually, one of the things they had pointed out with regards to the sort of anti-theist is there a point out that a number of those people are actually apostates.
Right.
Which, I don't know if that's important.
Well, I mean, it could only be that was a fluke in their statistics, right? Like if they happen to...
Well, or so maybe the way I would interpret it, and this I think goes on with what you're saying, is that it's hard to make certain correlations to a certain degree. But if you are an apostate, that implies you were religious before, which means a fundamental part of your identity had to be, at least from your own point of view, religious, right? So that kind of means that you think religion is really important in the world, and if you're pro or against, religion is going to be important in your world. So I think in that sense that there is sort of a track, whereas if you're in one of the other groups, right, I may have gone to church or whatever, but I don't consider myself an apostate because I was never really, you know, I never really believed.
Well, I mean, again, it's also self-selecting. If you're the kind of person to call yourself an apostate, you probably care that you used to be religious.
Yes.
Right? So that's going to impact how, I mean, if someone labels you an apostate, I guess I'm an apostate because I once went to church. I mean, I think that once you go, you're sort of in. Like, I don't know if I was baptized, but I wasn't baptized. I don't know, maybe I'm not part of the church.
No. Would you remember if you were baptized? That usually happens.
Well, I don't think my parents never mentioned it to me, but yeah.
You should ask them.
I should ask them, yeah. Well, let's take a quick break here. I'll phone my parents, and in the meantime, everyone stay tuned.
In the sky, standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Dawn.
Yeah, we are. Sorry, everything's just going boom on me at the moment.
Well, things...
Sorry. So, how old is ancient wisdom? That's something we've always asked. We've always wondered. Because everyone says, oh yes, this is ancient hand-down religion, that sort of thing. In fact, I've been reading a number of articles, vids, and that sort of thing that sort of say, you know, the things that we think we know are not really, we don't really know them. They're not true. So things like, you know, common hoaxes that people think are real, urban legends, famous misquotes, that sort of thing. So I thought, let's do a segment about ancient practices that aren't actually ancient. So Friday the 13th. So Friday the 13th, why is it such a cursed day? Well, the number 13 has been seen as an unlucky number, at least in the Christian world, since the 13th apostle apparently sold out the boss, at least according to that whole mythology sort of thing. Although, to be fair, the number 13 seems to date back even farther than that as an unlucky number. It seems that even the Babylonians avoided the number 13. And one of the interesting notes about this is in the Code of Hammurabi, which is about 1700 BCE, they skipped over the number 13. So you have law number 10, law number 11, law number 12, law number 14. You go, wait a minute, what happened to 13? I assume that was the prohibition on alcohol that they later repealed or some such thing like that. But what about Friday? Well, it does have some connections with the whole Jesus thing. That is believed that he was crucified on the Friday. But the second recorded mention of Friday the 13th actually doesn't really occur until Edward Sutherland Edwards in 1868, when he made a note in the biography of Giacone Rossini. In a quote goes, Rossini was surrounded to the last by admiring friends. And if it's true that, like so many Italians, he regarded Friday as an unlucky day and 13 as an unlucky number, it is remarkable that one Friday the 13th of November, he died. I don't know if November is unlucky too, but the modern urban legend about Friday the 13th actually seems to have its origin in a book written over about a century ago by Thomas Lawson in 1903 entitled Friday the 13th. It told the story of an evil businessman who attempted to crash the stock market on the unluckiest day of the month. It was a huge seller in the day. Think sort of like Dan Brown. And like a Dan Brown movie, Friday the 13th was turned into a movie in 1917. In more recent days, it was the blockbuster series of horror movies bearing the name Friday the 13th that has sort of cemented it in our popular culture. In fact, the Center for the Stress Management Center and Phobia Institute estimates that between $700 and $800 million are lost every Friday the 13th because people's refusal to travel, purchase major items, or conduct their businesses on Friday the 13th. Ethan, any thoughts about Friday the 13th? Do you get freaked out on that day?
Well, is the Stress Management Center and Phobia Institute really a real thing? It just sounds made up.
Yeah, it kind of does, but I didn't want to look at it too much because it wasn't that important. But it's one of those things, I mean, everyone kind of accepts, hey, it's Friday the 13th. But to be fair, you'd have to be pretty superstitious not to do that. But that being said, I mean, the Chinese have their thing with the number 4. Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, wasn't it in Vancouver they were trying to rename some parts of streets or whatever because it had 4 in them? Or there was some weird thing like that. So the fact that people have these phobias about particular numbers and dates.
Well, it's really strange because I've been in several hotels, apartment buildings. And, I mean, in most of them, they don't have a 13th floor. Nowadays in Vancouver, you're lucky if you have a 4th floor on a building, and you know usually 14 is sometimes out the door as well, and sometimes there's even a few others. So I mean, it is kind of remarkable the lengths we will go to accommodate what is essentially some of the most irrational thinking there could possibly be. Like, how could a single, I mean, how does it even work? Like, what is it? The planets all align, the gravity on the 13th day pulls you. I mean, there's no mechanism for this to happen. I mean, you have to basically believe that evil demons are running around or something, causing bad luck. There's just this bizarre concept that about this day that won't go away, and it's become so cemented, and we keep indulging it. I mean, it's ludicrous.
Well, you know, and the worst of it is that it's not even really that universal to a degree. So if you're having to be in a Spanish-speaking country, actually, apparently, it's Tuesday the 13th that's quite bad. The Greeks apparently think Tuesday the 13th is bad, too, and that's based upon, and again, this is very thin evidentiary evidence, that the fall of Constantinople during the Fourth Crusade happened on a Tuesday the 13th. So, ooh, must be bad. Hmm. And in fact, actually, and this is where, again, you have to worry about cultural biases. Apparently, in Italian culture, actually, Friday the 17th is considered to be the bad day in luck. Now, of course, this kind of contradicts the evidence I just mentioned about the biographer. But the biographer, I think, was British. So maybe he was assuming that the British think Friday the 13th is bad luck, therefore the Italians must, and he was just...
Or maybe he just, like, mistranslated something.
Maybe. Or maybe it was just he was making poetic license.
Who knows, yeah.
So the next one we're going to tackle is yoga. Most people think that yoga is as ancient as Buddha himself, that the practice of stretching, elaborate movements, have been handed down generation to generation for millennia. Well, sorry to burst your bubble, but no. Now, I should point out that the concept of yoga as a term referring to meditation is old. But it's just that. It's meditation as a term. It's like saying manufacturing is 10,000 of years old because they used to, quote, manufacture arrowheads and now we manufacture airplanes and it's the same manufacturing. Well, no, it's just it's a very generic sort of term. So when you do your research into yoga, you will find a long tradition, and when you read, you know, something about the descriptions, it's more about the concept and not about a practice. In fact, the only position mentioned in the Upanishads, that's sort of the Bible of the Hindus, is one position only, and that's sitting, right? So everything is just saying, you know, how do you meditate? Well, let me tell you how to meditate. And yoga means sort of meditate. That's sort of where the connection comes in. The practice of yoga that we sort of currently know can really trace its roots back to sort of the British colonial India. The idea of, you know, contorting your spine that somehow brings you great health or whatever can be kind of linked to what is the name? Krishnaja Wardyara III, a minor royal in India, an author who wrote a book whose name I will avoid. Ethan can laugh now because he can read the title. And it's can you do the title, Ethan?
Sirtavandiya?
Yeah. Maybe. There's no G in it, but... Anyhow, the Sirtavandiya, which apparently has 122 poses, mostly taken from Indian gymnastics. When you, of course, combine this with the late Victorian craze for exercise, this work provided sort of a great manual, at least in the Western eyes, to do sort of a workout. And, I mean, it's kind of odd. This is one of those times where people actually had to think about working out for the sake of a workout, because before that, you know, life was very hard and you did a lot of physical exercise just trying to keep yourself alive. But now you could sort of be lazy, especially if you're sort of a British colonial type who had, you know, paper job, you sat down on your butt all day, you had lots of money. So you actually had to worry about your sort of your health. So yoga really evolved in the sense that we know as far as the movements in that as just an exercise routine.
You know, the other thing that strikes me about this is that it may have also sort of caught on in kind of the, sort of fetishization of Eastern culture that I think was very popular around the late Victorian time of sort of, you know, mysticism and this kind of manufactured obsession.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that you start off with a little bit here and a little bit here, but you need a smoke and mirrors person to weave it all together. And it was not until BKS Yerga, who was taught yoga as an exercise routine, who married it with Hindu mysticism, that the sort of version of yoga that we know it currently exists came into being. If you're wondering, of course, when this happened, well, BKS is actually alive today at the ripe old age of 94. He introduced to the West, quote, Western yoga, in the 1960s in the best-selling book, Light on Yoga, and follows the path of so many other previous practitioners of Wu, a pseudoscience was born. So it's actually kind of an interesting thing, because, again, it's a tradition, and it's in scare quotes there, that actually can, in a very tortuous way, trace itself back to ancient times. But in the same way that, you know, we sort of lay claim that democracy, that has its path back to the Greeks,
right?
You know, kind of ignores the fact that really democracy died with the Greeks too, right? I mean, it wasn't really democracy as we think about it wasn't really invented until about 200 or 300 years ago, and even then, rather than 10 years.
Well, yeah, and also I think it speaks to the fact that we kind of have this myopia vision of democracy. I mean, democratic-like states have existed all over the globe at various points. I mean, the Iroquois, I think, have a greater claim on Western democracy than the Greeks do.
And then it comes down, and this is where, again, I think yoga is a great example. It's is it an amorphous term,
yeah,
or a specific definition? So the idea of people voting on a decision, well, that doesn't strike me as really that landmark, right?
The thing with yoga, too, and I mean, I know that we have listeners who are huge into yoga and swear by it as a way of exercising and meditation and all that. I mean, it's that doesn't mean that it wasn't an invention. I mean, that just means that it was successful.
Yes.
Like, I mean, every invention is either successful or it fails. And it's not surprising that somebody for maybe not honest means created something that actually can help people. And it's entirely possible that yoga can make you feel better. It doesn't mean, though, that it has this grand history that goes back thousands of years.
Well, and that goes with a lot of sort of, how do I put this? You know, certain belief systems. I'm trying to think of the right word here. But in California, there was a movement to ban yoga from school classrooms.
Right.
Because they were using yoga in the sense that this is an exercise sort of routine. Right, you know, you have to do these intricate movements. You know, it's good for the cardiovascular, it's good for hand-eye coordination, that sort of thing. But the parents thought that they were trying to indoctrinate their children in some kind of religion. And in one sense, that's true. In another sense, it's not. Because, again, the origins of the motions of yoga is actually, think of it as Indian gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until this pseudoscience guy comes along and tries to make it sort of more than what it really is that it takes off. And I mean, give him credit. I mean, talk about a winning combination. You know, a little woo with a little exercise seems to go a long way.
Oh, yeah.
So the next area we're going to talk about is tarot. Many people think tarot cards, that is divination via a deck of magical cards, has been around since the Egyptians. Well, again, no. You might think that... you might even think that the playing deck cards, you know, sort of evolved out of tarot cards. Again, no. In fact, it seems more likely the reverse is a reality. Playing cards seem to have first been created in China around and about 9th century. This century.
This side of...
The Common Era.
Yeah.
Yes. They migrated across the world and ended up in Europe around the 1400s. Now, you might think I'm talking about the standard or variation of the, you know, deck of cards you use for poker. But no, tarot cards themselves was actually a game. The word tarot has actually no etymology. That is, there is no real root to the word. It just seems to have been made up. Now, of course, some people say maybe it was a river in Italy that near where the cards were made. There is some suggestions that there may have been sort of an Arabic connection, but none of them have anything to do with sort of mysticism. The main feature of tarot cards was sort of the elaborate painting on the cards themselves, which were quite great works of art, right? If you ever look at tarot cards, they're quite beautiful to look at least the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
The game of tarot, or tarok, or tarochi, depending on your place of origin. Well, tarot itself is actually the French wordage, but it's essentially the game of hearts or bridge, where you play a game, you know, you got to play sort of the same suit that the guy before you did, and there are trump cards that you can play. At the end of each hand, you sort of count up points, and at the end, whoever has the most points wins the game. The mystic or divinatory meaning of the cards that we commonly think of today is actually derived from the cartomancer Jean-Baptiste Alliette in the 1700s. Now, for those of you unaware, cartomancy is not the usage of horse-drawn carts to tell someone's future, but the use of cards, i.e. playing cards, tarot cards, hockey cards, for the purpose of divining the future or the past. The origin, the original tarot deck was intended as nothing other than a game of cards or a game of chance did not prevent individuals from making it into something more than originally intended. And it is at this point that the connections between ancient Egypt, soon to be conquered by Napoleon, and the Jewish as sort of the, you know, the first nation of the world sort of came into it. So, you know, they kind of developed this sort of mythology about tarot, and then they needed some way to justify it. And what was really big in the culture time, and again in the French time, Egypt was a big craze at the time, all things sort of Egyptian. So they said, oh yes, this really traces its roots back to then. Again, creating sort of a false history, which is another common aspect of a lot of pseudoscience. Now, to be fair, in my youth, I dabbled in a bit of tarot. I don't think I ever really believed that it was mystical or anything, but I thought, like other forms of divinational woo, it did provide a way of self-examination. I mean, if you assume there is no sort of supernatural intervention, when all the meaning you bring, and I am assuming, of course, that we're talking about self-reading and not someone who's doing it for money, that adds a whole other dimension, but the meaning is brought by you. And in that way, it kind of forms a means of introvention or self-discovery. Ethan, any thoughts about that angle?
Well, I mean, it sort of actually kind of reminds me a lot of, I guess, maybe sort of the modern-day equivalent of you got your sort of your magic cards or your D&D. It's all about creating stories between cards, right? So you put down a card, go, okay, so this is the, I'm just going to, the Knight of Death, and this is, the Star of blah, blah, blah. And you craft a story about how these images come together and what they mean for you. So you go, this represents my determination, this represents my confidence, this represents my fears, and you create this narrative. So in that respect, it's very easy to understand why this would catch on, because people like doing that sort of thing. And the other interesting aspect about this is the sort of divining aspect, which came around in the 1700s, that was shortly before the craze of divination in general, where you had mediums and the table wrappers and
clairvoyance.
Yeah. So I mean, it probably fits in quite well. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to find, you know, if you did some more research, you'd get Arthur Conan Doyle's name popping up or something, you know. So
well, in the it would be, I think, pre, but just right around the cusp of the Romantic era, which also again had a lot of the sort of supernatural.
Oh yeah.
Connections.
Definitely.
Speaking of supernatural. Okay, so Satanism.
Uh-oh.
Yes. Now, this, of course, must be as old as Christianity. I mean, hell, even Judaism had sort of a, you know, Satanism, didn't it? Well, no. As it turns out, Satanism is fresher than the Beatles in Vietnam. It was created out of whole cloth by a musician from Chicago named Anton LaVey, who is probably well known to many people in the world. I knew him from a long time ago. Not that I'm a Satan worshiper, or I admit to it. Now, of course, you might say, Don, there was this thing, the Inquisition, that caught billions. Yeah, okay, I'm going to boost the numbers a little bit. Of worshippers of Satan, Satanists. Well, yes and no. Most, if not all, of those people were actually tortured beyond our modern comprehension of what the word torture is. If you sort of think waterboarding is bad, imagine rats burrowing through your intestines. So, well, it's not surprising that people would admit to anything at that particular point. And let us not forget that those people who worshipped a god other than Jesus were, again, really worshipping the devil. So what qualified this sort of Satan was very, very broad. And this also ignores the fact that Satan or the devil actually only really became a concept in the medieval ages. I mean, again, that takes it back a long way. But if you look back at like the really first religious texts, there is no real Satan. Satan is more of an envoy of God and not the opponent of God that he later evolved into. In fact, I believe it's Dante that gets most of the credit of creating the modern vision of
hell. I mean, I think that Milton also was sort of the pioneer of kind of the mythology of Satan. I think actually, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the whole concept of Satan / hell was almost rooted to like a mistranslation of the Hebrew Bible or something for like fire. It was mistranslated as like, I don't know the word, but sort of meaning a place of hell and burning, which was supposed to be like absence of God or something like that.
Well, and what is it? I think Genesis only refers to the beast.
Yeah.
And later on it was, oh, that actually means this here. So that's one aspect of it. And of course, that also overlooks the fact that quote unquote satanic symbols, the pentagram, the inverted cross, are actually Christian symbols.
Oh, yeah.
To avert black magic, in the case of the pentagram, actually, so Christians would use the pentagram to block off black magic. And you got to kind of love how the early Christian church were able to sort of ride both sides of there's one God, but oh yeah, there's also magic out there, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of, and of course, the inverted cross, which actually turns out to be the cross of Peter, the founder of the Catholic Church. Apparently, he said that that he was requested that the crucified be turned upside down because he didn't feel worthy of dying the same way that Jesus was killed. And, okay, sure. I mean, I don't know. I'm speechless. I'm literally speechless. So it turns out, you know, so that's that. Okay, but let's go into the other, you know, religious sort of thing, the witches or Wicca. So Wicca, paganism, white magic. It has been around forever, right? Well, the Wicca's belief in the Earth Mother. Again, it must be the first religion ever. No? Again, no. Wicca is what we call neo-paganism. What they're that is that there was sort of, you know, pagans and white witches thousands of years ago, but they're all dead for millennia. So what do we do if you're, you know, sort of unsatisfied with established religions? You have a predilection for feminism and a sense of the super spirituality. You create out of nothing your what you envision to be an ancient but completely forgotten and lost mythology. Now, let's give it its dues. It does actually predate Satanism by a few years. And to be fair, the idea of white magic is actually kind of part of the romantic revival of the 18th century. But credit, if I can bestow credit, really I think goes to Gerald Gardner, who in 1954, as a retired English civil servant, spent most of his life in the Far East and published Witchcraft Today, in which he made claims to have encountered members of the witch cult. The witch cult was originally described by Margaret Murray in the 1920s, who tried but failed to link it with pagan beliefs and Satanism. Regardless, it seems that Wicca actually gets its start in sort of the 1950s, 1970s, when it really gained strength. It was combined with, you know, environmentalism, egalitarianism, feminism, and a sort of a spirituality that mixed, that had a perfect mix for sort of the disillusioned Christian. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, it's not surprising that Wicca sort of became a religion of empowerment for women. That's why it has a strong connection with feminism. Not so much because only women can do it, but you had like the traditional Catholic churches, Protestant churches, which were very man-centric, very male-centric. Well, here is a way for you to be spiritual and in touch with the mother goddess as opposed to father god.
Mm-hmm.
And it served an interesting social role, still serves a very interesting social role. But I mean, it's not ancient. It's like really, really fresh.
Well, the funny thing about it is the idea that it's a religion that is ancient and forgotten. Well, then how do you know it's ancient? Like it doesn't. Once you say that it's from a long-lost religion, but then it's not really lost, is it now?
No.
And the other aspect of it that's interesting, even if that were true, most of what we know about pre-Christian paganism comes from Christians writing about how horrible they were. So it's really hard to gain. Like, this is one of the reasons why I think a lot of archaeologists get really, like, fussy about claiming that Stonehenge was built by Druids, because we don't really know anything about Druids other than that they may have existed.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to make these connections when your source of information is from people who hated them.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of difficult from a point of view of going, this ancient belief system, which has somehow remained intact outside of the purview of any academic researchers for thousands of years, has been discovered by a group of modern-day egalitarian feminists, environmentalists, who have created a ancient religion. No, you've invented something from whole cloth, which is not to say that it's any less invalid than the Catholic Church.
No,
but it's
it was also invented out of whole cloth.
Honestly, I think if I'm going to pick one of them, I'm probably going to go with Wiccan. But it's... Yeah, like this connection to the ancient past, which is actually kind of the common theme of all of these things, is that we're trying to draw this.
Well, it's justification ad historium, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Listen, you know, you have to believe in this because it's really, 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 really old. It's been around forever, so it must be true. Because if it wasn't true, they would have gotten rid of it a long time ago. Just like, what was it I was listening to the other day? Bloodletting. There was a show where someone was doing an absolute horrible job of condemning / defending alternative medicine. So he was, you know, promoting medicine, but he was trying to condemn alternative medicine. And the person brought up, you know, the fact that, well, you know, what about, you know, using leeches? Leeches are now used quite commonly in medicine. And it's like, well, yes, but for a completely different purpose than what they were originally used. They were originally used to balance your humors. And literally, people were bled to death in the old days. Whereas now it's used as a means to allow a better blood flow to areas that have been amputated or suffering from gangrene or something like that. So it's not the bloodletting part that was right. The fact that they use leeches... coincidental.
Yeah, right. And I would kind of believe that if you're going to use leeches, it's probably like a last resort. Oh shoot, we're out of clean needles, like you know.
Well, actually, we're going on a tangent here, and my apologies about that. But no, apparently there's something in the saliva of the of leeches,
natural anticoagulant, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that actually helps helps prevent areas that can't drain normally because of tissue damage. So, you know, you get a bruise and it swells up, right? Well, that swelling usually isn't good, and sometimes it can become critical, and you need to get rid of that swelling. Leeches come to the job, and they can help promote the but again, I actually think this is a good analogy to yoga. I mean, yes, in the one sense, they're both using leeches, so you can tenuously sort of trace a path back to 1000 AD, but it totally has different meanings now. I mean, they're not using it for that reason. The reasons that they used to use it were totally different. They were totally different context. It's just there's one little tenuous thread that you can lay out and like, see, it's ancient. It's like, no, it's not.
Well, it's sort of like when people try to claim that germ theory or our modern day physics descends from the ancient Greek atomists or something. We had similar name, and it's if you do enough mental gymnastics, you can sort of make it fit, but it's not the same thing.
Well, and our prophecy in the Bible, or yeah. Muhammad knew the cure for 15 diseases because he said the word honey once.
Yeah.
And honey is now a curative. It's like, no. It's just, it drives me nuts.
It does, yes. Well, Don, we're actually kind of running out of time.
But we're going to do one other thing. Sorry, just because we're going to mention this tenuous thing, and I want to prep everyone. So we already mentioned one. We're going to do an anti-vax thing. Next week, I want to talk about, is Norse religion real? Was
Norse
really
religion?
A god? Was Odin really a god?
Well, I think that we figured that out when that documentary came out, Thor.
Yes, it was a huge, huge thing. Yeah, so anyhow, that's a precursor for next week, and related to what we were talking about. So that's what I'm throwing out there.
Okay.
So, I don't have any skeptic highlights this week, Ethan, but I do have some quick picks.
You don't have a skeptical highlight this week?
No, but quick picks are better.
All right, so
these
if you say so.
These are sort of like skeptic highlights, I guess, but they're just quick little things. So I came across a couple of websites that I thought, hey, these are great things. You should go check them out. One is physicsgames.net. Now, can you guess what that's about, Ethan?
Is it physics and games?
Yes, it's actually a whole suite of little mini little sort of flash games that help teach you about physics and how, you know, physics works and how that. This is maybe for the junior crowd or for the people who are bored. One there I like was called just simply The Scientific Experiment. And it's one of those things, it's like Angry Birds, but for the nerdy class. The other one, another website, is the Periodic Table of Vids. So essentially, this is the periodic table, and you click on helium, and you get a video that explains, hey, this is what helium is. Here's some neat little facts about helium you didn't know. Quite often, they have some very spectacular experiments showing how stuff interacts with other stuff. And I thought that was pretty good. The other one, last one, is sort of a YouTube. It's based out of the TED Talks series. And it's If Superpowers Were Real. Joe Lynn tackles six superpowers and reveals just how scientifically realistic they can be on us mere mortals. So it covers things like super speed, super strength, being able to fly, turning invisible, immortality, and if you could turn yourself into sort of giant man, and how it would really work in reality if these were true.
Hmm.
It was quite an interesting little series. And they're quite short little quick bits. You know, it's not like a PBS documentary where you sit down for an hour and a half and go, oh my God, no, just get on with it. Ethan,
yes.
Do you have any skeptical highlights?
I do. I have one. There is a CFI Cafe Inquiry coming up called Senate Second Thoughts. And
oh,
it's
yes.
Hosted by some guy, Don McLean.
Don McLennigan.
There you go.
Yeah.
If he sounds familiar, that's because he's sitting right over there.
Yes.
But anyway, this is going to be a fun event. There's been lots of talk about the Senate here in Canada, what it does, how it works, and of course the mirage in the desert of Senate reform and what possible form that could take. So we're very happy that Don will be joining us to lead a discussion on that.
Did you know, Ethan, that if it wasn't for the Senate, Canada would not exist as a country?
Really?
Do you know why?
Why?
You show up to the show and you
ooh,
talk and you
that's that's good. The cafe is happening on Saturday, July 20th at 1 p.m. at the Tipper Restaurant. The Tipper is very generously giving us room for free. So if you do come, please get some food, have a drink or two, and make it worth them for being such good hosts for us. And again, the 20th at 1 p.m. and Don will be there. So yay. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, and I want to say thank you for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on, or something.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.